Today is October 4th, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Project, today I am interviewing John Henn about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. John, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born actually in Evansville, Indiana, in 1941, so we were pretty much geared to the war effort. My dad was in the aircraft industry, and so we moved to California in end of 44, because the aircraft industry in Indiana was kind of dying down, but it was starting up in California, so he moved us all to Southern California.
Okay.
The smartest thing he ever did.
So you grew up in Southern California.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about growing up in Southern California and a little bit about your family life.
Well, I had three sisters. And when we first moved here, we lived in Huntington Beach. And I should say on Huntington Beach because we were in a travel trailer, a 25-foot long travel trailer. Me and my three sisters, my mom and dad, and our dog, 25-foot trailer.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were like 10 feet from the sand in Huntington Beach because there was a long strip where people could come and camp and that. But you could also stay extendedly just by taking out the permit and stuff. So that's what we did.
Okay.
And my dad worked at Hughes Aircraft in Long Beach. So it was real close. And, you know, we were just kind of beach rats for the first few years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So was volleyball the first sport that you played, or did you play any other sports?
Oh, no, I grew up playing baseball. I mean, my dream was to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when then Jackie Robinson came along in 47, and, you know, he was a hero of ours. And you know, we played baseball whenever we could. And I didn't pick up volleyball until we had moved then to San Diego, and I was probably in junior high school and saw beach volleyball. Some older guys were playing beach volleyball here, and you know, it was kind of attractive because, you know, you're in a nice environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting sport just because of all the skills that it took.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of got me involved. And my father, who had moved down to San Diego then with us, and he was working at Convair, which is was a big aircraft industry then, and they had a industrial league, and so he started playing, and kind of I tagged along. I was like 13 or 14, and I was still playing baseball at the time. But, you know, I'd go with him to the gym and, you know, start learning some of the skills. And so that, you know, that was kind of fun for me, and good relationship, father and son kind of deal. So that was pretty cool. So he kind of got me into it. He took me to La Jolla Shores one time to watch one of the beach tournaments. And a lot of teams from Los Angeles had come down, and, you know, there were some renowned beach volleyball players then, Ronnie Lang and Gene Selznick and Mike O'Hara, Mike Bright, those guys, and that was an inspiration to me, watching those guys and how good they were. So that was pretty much how I got into it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of gave up on baseball when I was a junior in high school because it just took too much time away from the beach. So.
Oh, you liked being on the beach.
Yeah. I mean, you know, who wouldn't?
Right. Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened for me.
So what drove you to excel or motivated you to excel in volleyball?
You know, my friends started playing as I did, and it was exciting for me because the different skills involved, and you know, back in those days you kind of refereed yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, lifting the ball and double hitting the ball, which were violations, and so you kind of took pride in accomplishing those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity then to join I guess this was 63 or 64. I had the opportunity to join a club in Los Angeles where all these best players played. Mm-hmm. And so it was up to me to make a decision, you know, to drive up there to practice and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which, you know, it was okay. The drive wasn't too bad, a couple hours. And then you got to play with, you know, the best players in the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was able to measure my skills and improve my skills and improve my knowledge of the indoor game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was taking some classes at college. And during the summer, I would play beach volleyball till about 4, then get in the car and drive to Los Angeles, get there 6:30 or so. We practice from 7 to 9:30, and then I drive home. Mm-hmm. And I'd do that twice a week. And then every 2 weeks, we'd have a tournament on Saturday. So I'd go drive up again and put those things into practice with the best players in the country. Mm-hmm. So you were able to kind of build your confidence and become better and, you know, get critiqued by the better players, the more experienced players. And so you learn. Mm-hmm. And it was an exciting time for me.
Yeah.
And making the drive turned out to be a boon because on the way up, you could think about your preparation, what you would hope to accomplish in that particular practice. Mm-hmm. And then on the drive home, you evaluate. So all those things, I think, kind of sped my level of play.
Yeah.
And I had a friend here named Richard Wiseman. Bunky was his nickname. Mm-hmm. And he was an accomplished player. He had gone to the 63 Pan American Games. And he was also a Marine Corps pilot. Or he was in training. Mm-hmm. He was in the Marine Corps and taking pilot's training. And he was stationed down in Pensacola, Florida, and they were doing touch and go landings, which is like a landing on an aircraft carrier and then immediately lifting off.
Yeah.
But they weren't on the carrier, they were on ground. So they had a target to hit and then an accelerate out of the area, and he crashed and was killed. So, you know, that was big. I mean, that really touched me quite a bit because he had given me some tips, you know, just in my own game, and he was a highly respected player. So it kind of motivated me to, you know, take that step and get involved in the international game. And I was in a perfect place to do it because of the players mm-hmm. that were around.
Yeah.
So
in those days, how was your training and competition supported financially?
We basically supported ourselves. Mm-hmm. When I was in the club team that I was talking about was the Hollywood YMCA, and they had won, I don't know, 5 or 6 indoor open national championships. So they were, you know, highly regarded, one of the top teams in the country. And so the coach there, Harry Wilson, was involved in the administration of U.S., let's see what they call it at the time, the United States Volleyball Association, USVBA. And so politically, it was a good place to be. Mm-hmm. Because if you needed a little political help along the way, he would be able to speak for you or not, depending on, you know, how you got along with mm-hmm. him. But, you know, he had a reputation of running a solid program. And any expenses, they really didn't pay, but you could make contributions to the YMCA and then kind of get it back in terms of a write-off, having donated to a nonprofit and that kind of thing. So, so that, you know, there wasn't much in terms of subsidization.
Right.
But, you know, if you had the desire, you could go a long way. And so that's basically what happened. And although being kind of new on the scene, when the Olympic trials came in 64, the biggest expense was getting to New York City. The 64 Open National Champions was supposed to be here in San Diego, but the World's Fair was going on in mm-hmm. New York City, or scheduled to go on. And so they asked most of the amateur sports to, let's move your venue for your championship and Olympic trials to the New York City area so we could work it in conjunction with the World's Fair. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, okay, that sounds like a good deal. So, you know, the only expense for us then was to get to New York. And, you know, thanks to my mom and dad, they kicked in the airfare for me and made the donation to the YMCA in Hollywood. And then they bought the tickets, and so they were able to get to write off. So that's how that worked.
Okay. So that's pretty interesting.
And, you know, I was fortunate enough to get selected for the training team just because of my performance there. And our team did really well. We're all young guys. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up beating our fellow Hollywood YMCA team, which had all the experienced players on it. So, you know, we opened some eyes as far as the youth movement in the United States. And so, it kind of helped those few of us that got involved with the national team that were young. And then the administrators of USA Volleyball could see that the sport wasn't going to die after the Olympic Games, because I knew a lot of the experienced players were going to retire. They were, you know, early 30s and what have you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were just early 20s. Mm-hmm. So we had a nice future ahead of us. And so that's kind of how it worked out. We, aside from some of the political maneuverings, you know, so-and-so being left off and, you know, why did this guy get selected and all those kind of things. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, we got to, we then fell under the U.S. Olympic Committee, and we were taken to Los Angeles for training for 2 weeks. You know, we stayed at the Ambassador Hotel, and all the meals were free, and we'd drive in the evening to Santa Monica City College for practice. Mm-hmm. Because some of the guys who were on the team from Los Angeles, they were allowed to work at their jobs during the day, so we practice at night. So for those of us who are just in L.A., just hanging out, you know, we could go to the beach, we could do anything during the day,
yeah,
just be at practice at night. And so, that, you know, again, that was pretty cool because we just played volleyball and had a good time.
Yeah, so, yeah. How was your training and competition psychologically supported by friends and family?
Oh, great. Yeah, I had great support from my family, and they knew and what I was about and, you know, what my goals were. And as you meet these milestones as a young player, you know, kind of proving yourself and having success at that level, I remember talking to my dad about it. I didn't talk to my mom or sisters that much about it, but I think my sisters were probably more involved with doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. And my mom was, you know, she was the mom. I mean, she did all the house stuff. And I mean, that was the generation back then. And so, but I could see my dad, you know, he had some pride in what I was doing. I used to give him, you know, the little things that we would get, little medals and things to hand out to people. And I'd always give him several of those to, he could keep them on his desk at work and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And he and I would sit every once in a while and talk about volleyball because he had played at his level and was real interested. So yeah, it worked out really well, I think.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't speak for the other guys. I would assume it was the same.
Yeah. What about your social life? Did you ever feel like your training and competition schedule interfered with your social life, or was volleyball kind of the center of your social life?
Yeah, it kind of was the center. You know, my girlfriend ended up being my wife. You know, she didn't play, but she was she liked the beach, and so it was a good environment.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we would go to the tournaments, and when we played on the beach, I mean, you know, we'd drive to Los Angeles or Santa Barbara or Orange County, Manhattan Beach, and I mean, what a great environment. And so, she was in favor of all that.
Okay.
You know, we bought a Volkswagen bus, and you know, if we got somewhere where we didn't have the money for a motel room or whatever, we'd sleep in the bus. I mean, that's what was going on.
Yeah.
I still have that bus, by the way.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh yeah, had it restored a couple years ago.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Yeah. I love those buses.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So tell me about the 1967 Pan Am team and the games there.
Well, I played on the national team in 65, and 66 we went to the World Championships in Czechoslovakia, and we didn't do really well, but that, you know, we understood, you know, we didn't have a full-time training program like the national team does now. I mean, if they're not training here, they're on a break from training, or they're all playing professionally in Europe. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's way different now than what we did. I mean, you know, we'd play in a beach tournament or whatever, and, you know, you'd get a trophy, or, you know, we used to kid each other about having played for a glass of Kool-Aid or something. But, you know, in perspective, I mean, I would have loved to have been subsidized where you could spend more time doing that. But it just wasn't the case in those days.
Yeah.
You know, the guys now, when they play in Europe, I mean, they're making six figures, the guys. Mm-hmm. And so they go there for 6-7 months, and they're set. I mean, one of the players that I played with's son was our most valuable player at the Beijing Olympics.
Oh, wow.
He played on a club in Russia and makes, well, I don't know, he might be retired now, but he made over $700,000 for 7 months.
My goodness.
Okay. So that's the kind of money that's out there for these guys now.
Wow.
And, you know, there's no way they could make that money here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, especially not playing volleyball. I mean, if they had an executive job somewhere, most guys don't make that much money.
Oh, that's incredible. So, that is really incredible.
Yeah.
So anyway,
the Pan Am Games in Winnipeg. Great experience. They had the opening ceremonies, and you got all the, you know, the USA gear and stuff like that. And it was an exciting time because even at the World Championships, they didn't have that stuff. You know, the USA volleyball at the time, they bought us a Russell sweatsuit and had USA stitched on it. And I think we had one pair of game shorts, two jerseys that were like basketball jerseys, and we had to wear our own shoes.
Oh, wow!
And we had to take our own practice gear. I remember, we had a picture of us lining up on the end line before a scrimmage against Bulgaria, I think it was, and somebody took a picture of us. And every once in a while, these kids with these pictures would come around where we were staying, you know, offering them up and that. And so I got one of the pictures. I think I had to pay for it, but it wasn't much. And I had my practice uniform was my Hollywood YMCA jersey. And I had a pair of these basketball shorts. They were like the Globetrotters wear, you know, and I just happened to put them on for this thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we looked so schlock. It was unbelievable. Because we were all different. All had different stuff on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that it was just kind of, but that's what they did in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the Pan Am Games in 67, then since it was under the Olympic Committee auspices, they had some nice stuff.
Oh, that's
and I remember our manager, whether he had forgotten to order or what he ordered didn't come, but we had no game shorts. So he had to go out to a sporting goods store and buy just cotton, like gym shorts for us.
Mm-hmm.
The jerseys were nice, but we were wearing these cotton gym shorts to play. And, the parade gear and all that stuff was pretty cool, having that and going through the march in and the opening ceremonies, which to me was great. I mean, you know, all these different countries and, you know, since it was the Pan Am game, it was only half the world, but mm-hmm. still, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And The other thing I remember was the food. The food was unbelievable. The first day we got there for lunch, they had these big steam trays as you go along, and they were heaping with lobster and then steak and then just... So wow. The manager of our team, realizing what was going to happen, he went out and bought us scales. And he'd weigh us in every morning. We'd have to get up and get on the scales, and he'd write it down. Because after a while, we would eat by the watch. How long can you eat today? You know, we'd have contests. There's a guy who ended up coaching at UCLA, Al Skates. And he ended up with the record. And he ate. It was unbelievable how long he ate. And the thing was, you had to keep putting it in, and you had to keep chewing. That was the criteria.
Oh, wow.
And he must have been there for close to 2 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
It was pretty fun. And then all the ice cream and stuff. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Very cool.
And we had a good tournament. We ended up winning the gold medal, although we lost to Brazil. We had already won enough games. That's how you broke the tie. I think it was a percentage of games played and the number having won against the fewest loss.
Mm-hmm.
So after we won the fourth game, after we won the fourth game in a five-set match, I should say, the way it is now, we already knew we had clinched. So the fifth game didn't matter to us, although we wanted to win the match. We didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost to Brazil, but we won the gold medal, and the medal ceremony was pretty nice. You know, getting up on the podium and all that.
It was
very memorable.
So what about the 68 trials? What do you remember about those trials?
The 68 trials. Gosh, I'm just trying to think if I get it mixed up with the Pan Am trials. Wow, I'm just drawing a blank there. The thing that I do remember was that I didn't get hurt. I mean, I felt good physically the whole time. So, you know, that was really the best chance.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nagging injuries, you couldn't perform at your top over a long duration.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate there. I was fortunate there.
Mm-hmm.
And the system that we had played, which is called a 6-2, where you actually designate two of the six players as setters. And to keep balance in the offense, you would use the player, the one of the two setters, when he was in the back row, you would use him to come to the front and distribute the ball.
Okay.
So he didn't ever attack. And when you rotated then to the front, you weren't responsible for the setting duties. You became an attacker. So you were pretty much one of the best all-around players.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do both of those and then play defense and block and all those things. So that I liked that because you were always involved and touched the ball a lot. And you know, you kind of kept in mind who of your hitters were being successful, and in relation to where you were in a particular match, the important points, so you could make sure you got the ball to the guy who, you know, you needed to be successful at that point in time.
Yeah.
It took that responsibility away from the horses,
mm-hmm.
let's say, who really needed to work on their blocking and make sure they got up on the quick set in the middle and all those things, so they didn't have to think too much. They just kind of frothed at the mouth and did what they do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I enjoyed my role in that offense.
Yeah.
Later on, when the offenses went to what they call a 5-1, where you only had one setter, then you never got to hit. You never got to attack. All you did was distribute the ball, which, number one, was an advantage because you could add another stronger attacker in, as one of the five. And then the setter, all he did was thinking about setting and that. But, you know, I love to attack, so I don't think I could have done that job. But that came along after me, so it worked out okay. I came along at the right time for what I did.
So. How did your friends and family members react to finding out that you had made the Olympic team?
Oh, they thought it was great. I mean, I got a lot of support from everybody, I mean, all the guys I hung out with at the beach and played beach against and all that. I mean, most of those guys played indoor as well, and you know, we were competitive, but we were still friends, and you know, their level was, I guess, maybe they didn't jump as well, or weren't as passionate as I was, or maybe they thought they were better than me. I don't know. And then just didn't get picked. So, you know, it all worked out, I think. You know, some of those guys and I we still talk about the old days, and we had lunch together and all that. But it's just the way it was. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So, as you were preparing for the games to go to Mexico City, did you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, my wife had planned, her mother and stepfather had gotten tickets. And they, with another couple, drove from San Diego to Mexico City.
Oh, wow.
To see the Olympics. Well, of course, my wife says, hey, I'm going.
Yeah.
You know, load the kids in the bus, and, you know, I'll drive it down there. And I'm thinking, I don't know if that's such a good idea. But she was going to be with her parents and this other couple, so I figured, well, you know, and Mexico was pretty safe at that time. We used to go down there all the time in the bus and camp out and stuff. But when we got to, well, we had trained for like 6 weeks in Lake Tahoe to get used to the altitude down there. And, you know, my wife and I would talk on the phone and this, that, and the other. And then, you know, I'm hearing things about these protests and students and, you know, they're getting machine gun and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, wow, that doesn't sound very good. But when we left Tahoe, we were taken to Denver. That's where we got all of our Olympic clothing and our shots and all this stuff. And the full Olympic team had congregated in Denver to go through this process. And so we're in the hotel and I'm watching TV. And it was bad. I mean, the army were coming out. They had helicopters flying over. And the University of Mexico was just a short distance from the Olympic Village and the opening ceremony venue and all that stuff. And so I called home. I says, hey, you ain't going. Oh, do you have to go? I said, no. I said, you turn on the TV and then you tell me. Because there's no way that I can, you know, I can, wherever you are in Mexico City, if they lock us down, I can't get to you and you can't get help. I'm sorry. And, you know, for you to try to run to the U.S. Embassy when things start going really bad, it's just not good. So she didn't go, and she held that against me for a long time.
Oh.
But it was just the way it was.
Yeah.
You know, I just couldn't, I didn't feel that I could just give up that control. And I'm, you know, I mean, I'm pretty much sequestered where we were. And, you know, there were a couple of guys that did. Tommy Hain, one of the guys from Hawaii, had his wife come. And she stayed with a nice family, and it worked out okay for her. And then Larry Rundle, he had his girlfriend, and I don't even know where she stayed. And I don't know how many others. Maybe Smitty, the player from Texas, maybe he had his wife. I didn't pay much attention because it was a distraction. And if you had to think in family terms while this was going on, it wasn't It wasn't the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So.
I can see that.
Yeah.
So what about the U.S. track team and some of the talk about boycotts that was going on?
Well, we had heard some things. And just being around the Olympic Village, I mean, the track athletes always had media within arm's distance of them at all times. I mean, so they were, you know, they were getting their message out, but they were also, they acted as a buffer because the media would immediately go to them and didn't spend much time with the other athletes, although the crew, our eight-man crew, they were huge back in the black athletes for their protesting. And there's a book called Something in the Air that was written. And, you know, I mean, we had heard some things, but nothing to the extent that was written in that book.
Yeah.
I mean, those rowers getting called in by the USOC and, you know, these guys are going to Harvard.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to mess with them? Well, USOC did.
Yeah.
Hey, you do this and, you know those jobs, those political jobs that you're thinking about getting or those stockbroker jobs, you can forget about it because we will get you.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it came down to. And,
yeah.
You know, and then, you know, as I followed Tommy Smith's career and John Carlos's career after the Olympic Games, you know, those guys, their message was good. But I'm telling you, the guy that really made out on that deal was Edwards, the professor.
Right.
And if you really looked at it, he used those guys for his deal. They might have believed it, but they paid. I remember there was a report. Tommy Smith became a track coach at Santa Monica City College. And so one afternoon, the police just came and just, I mean, I don't know whether they locked down the campus or whatever, because there was a report of a black guy with a handgun on campus. Well, guess who it was? It was the track coach on the track with a starter's pistol.
Oh, my goodness.
It was Tommy Smith.
Oh, my goodness.
So he's face down, you know, out there with a cop holding a gun on him.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, and then John Carlos, you know, I don't know how educated a guy he was, but he was pretty astute. If he were to come along now, you know, he wouldn't have any problem with money because he would get endorsements.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that back then.
Yeah.
Those guys, there was a big thing between Puma and Adidas, whereby Adidas was the accepted brand within the Olympic Village, I think it was, or Olympic venues, whatever. And so Puma was trying to make some inroads, and they would leave a pair of shoes first, you know, one of the athletes, Carlos or whoever, Tommy Smith, and they would go pick up the pair of shoes, and there'd be like $10,000 in cash in one of the shoes. That's how they kind of surreptitiously got the Puma brand on the track. And if you go back and look at the pictures, those guys that are wearing Puma probably got a nice piece of change during the Olympic Games. So, you know, there were some things going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were kind of in our own thing. You know, the days we didn't compete, we practiced. And so there weren't really many days off. We'd play 3 days and then have a day off, play three and have a day off. And single round robin. And then the team with the best records were awarded. And so we played the Soviet Union, the first match. And at the World Championships, they tended to always put the U.S. and the Soviet Union in one of the first matches because they were the world champion and, you know, they would go on and have a nice record. And us, we were kind of an unknown quantity. So they didn't want to wait till, you know, you got close to the end of the games. because you know we might have a 2-7 record and they're having a 9-0 record. Who's going to come? Mm-hmm. It's already a done deal. But we played them the first match, mm-hmm. and we played really well, and we beat them, and they never lost another match the whole Olympics. I think the coach got a hold of them and said, hey, you guys are going to the salt mines if you don't do better. But we had nothing to lose. We were we thought we were pretty good, but you never know.
Yeah.
But we played well on that occasion, and just looking across the net, you could see in their eyes that they were a little worried because they weren't the momentum wasn't changing. When we got it, we built on it, and especially their younger players. Their younger players were very worried about their situation because if they lost this, then they had to deal with the East Germans and the Czechs and the teams that were in the elite category. Mm-hmm. And to not win a gold medal, they could lose their apartment, they could lose their car, whatever benefits that they had that the normal person didn't have. Mm-hmm. So it was worrisome for them. You could see it.
Yeah. Did you feel the effects of the Cold War, or do you think the Cold
War?
Well,
we knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. I think some of us knew more than others, just because they were more politically astute. Mm-hmm. I was in a place where I could kind of separate that. Mm-hmm. I'm a liberal anyway, so you heard. The Soviets moving into Czechoslovakia the same year and those kind of things. And yeah, it didn't affect us physically, but if you thought more globally, you could see the effect. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't like that at the time. I'm more like that now. Mm-hmm. I think I've kind of matured globally, politically, mm-hmm. since then.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Did you have any memorable interactions with anybody from the Soviet bloc?
Not really memorable. We traded jerseys. We had traded jerseys with several of them in 66. And they remembered us when we played them again in 68. Mm-hmm. Of course, we didn't play them in 67. So, there was a two-year break before we met them in 68, but we remembered them. We knew all their names. I doubt that they knew ours. Mm-hmm. We used to talk to people about Fingerovsky and Valery Krivchenko and those guys who were to us the heroes because of who they were. Mm-hmm. I doubt that they really spent much time thinking about who we were. And that might have helped us in this particular match. Mm-hmm. But we played well. We played well. Mm-hmm. And
What about the altitude? Did you notice the effects of the high altitude? Or did Lake Tahoe and Denver prepare you sufficiently?
We didn't do much practicing in Denver, but because we weren't there that long, just a couple of days. But, it helped us, and I'll tell you how it helped us. The ball, and very much like now you hear about baseball being played in Denver, mm-hmm. and it's not like real baseball. The field, they've designed the field bigger so that because the ball flies. And the thing that we noticed in volleyball, even later when I was coaching and going up to BYU, the spin on the ball didn't really affect the flight that much, whereby if you hit a nice tight topspin ball at sea level, you're going to get the you've played table tennis, right? Ping pong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you spin the ball and how it kind of makes that that kind of
arc.
Yeah, but it's a kind of a funny arc, an oblong kind of arc. Uh-huh. Well, you could do that with volleyball as well, but at altitude it didn't happen. So the same ball that you would spin to hit near the sideline or back line, it would go long.
Oh, wow.
So you had to adjust. And so that was, that was something we had to learn in being at Tahoe before we went to Mexico City. Mm-hmm. By the time we got there, then we pretty much knew. But it can be an effect. Mm-hmm. And if you read stories about our track athletes and their ability to breathe or not breathe, however the case, it's funny too, because I was at San Diego State at the time as an undergraduate, and one of my instructors, Lindsay Carter, was a physiologist for the athletic department. He was a track coach, and he started doing studies mm-hmm. on track athletes and endurance training and the breathing and exchange of oxygen and O2 and oxygen and CO2. Anyway, he had gone to Mexico City and was down there. I met him where he was drawing blood from athletes and then testing for, you know, the differences and all that. It was very interesting study. And he was also into body types, you know, the big throwers against the sprinters and the distance runners against the swimmers and body fat and all that. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, we were just kind of getting into that, studying the effects of body types and oxygen levels and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting time.
Yeah, definitely. For that. But in terms of the science of human performance, mm-hmm. for sure. So going back to your arrival in Mexico City, what were your impressions of the city and the people?
In getting off the plane, when they opened the door, the humidity and the heat, and it had just rained, and even approaching the airport as you got low, the ground around Mexico City was red. It was like Hawaii. You know, a lot of iron in the soil.
Yeah.
And they had these armies of people go out and paint the hovels or the whatever you want to call it, where the poor people lived, mm-hmm. because the plane was coming in and you could just look out and see, you know, these shanties. And so these armies of people went around and painted those in different pastel colors.
Mm.
So now you have the red dirt, you have the dark sky because it had just rained,
uh-huh.
and then these pastel colors all around you. And so, you know, and that was pretty cool. And then when they opened the door and you smelled the humidity and just the scent of the after rain, and I won't forget that for sure. And then every afternoon, boy, they'd have these thunderstorms. And next to the Olympic Village was our transportation center. And so we would go, when we were going to practice or a match or whatever, we'd go to the transportation center at a prescribed time, and these buses would take us, mm-hmm. you know, to the venue. And where the buses loaded, there were these bars that wouldn't allow spectators or people just off the street to get in, right? But their faces were just always like jammed up against, just to see the foreigners or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously we're sitting there and we're looking right back at them, and you know, they were poor. They were the peons, the peones, and standing in the rain. They have a shawl over, lady have a shawl over her head, carrying a baby or whatever. And they just stand there for hours, just watch us.
Wow.
So it's kind of like a zoo. We were kind of like in a zoo. But yeah, they were nice. I mean, the people, you know, whenever we'd see them going in and out of the venue, mm-hmm. you know, we'd say hello and, you know, before we got on the bus. But we didn't have a whole lot of contact unless you left the Olympic Village on your own,
mm-hmm.
And then went out into the city. I didn't do that much.
Yeah.
You know, I was there to do this, and I think some of the guys that had their wives and girlfriends there, they probably did.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do it much.
What was your impression of the Olympic Village?
Oh, it was nice. Mm-hmm. It was really nice. I mean, they had built it to sell as condominiums after the games. So they've completed it. I mean, all the landscaping was there, and we had a practice track right in the middle next to the seven different cafeterias
mm-hmm.
for the athletes. And they specialized in what part of the world you were from,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally we would go into the European one because they served wine with their meals. But, you know, we didn't partake. It was just, you know, a unique thing to do.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, the facilities were great. They were a little Spartan in that they weren't, you know, they didn't have pictures on the walls and stuff like that. I mean, it was concrete floor, concrete walls. But, you know, the beds, they were single beds and, you know, they were all uniform. And they had bed covers on that had the Olympic logo on them. So it was pretty nice. I think the first couple of days we had problems with showers. And then they got that squared away.
Mm-hmm.
Much different than the Pan Am Games. When we got to Winnipeg, we actually stayed in on an army base and stayed in their billets for their troops. But they had no screens on the windows.
Hmm.
And this was like end of July. The mosquitoes were this big.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I mean, the welts, they would leave welts on you, big red welts like this. And, you know, the Canadians used to kid it. It was their kid us that it was their national bird. And, boy, you could believe it. Those things would carry off a small dog. So anyway, we complained about the lack of screens on the windows in Winnipeg, and the Army came and put some screens up for us.
Oh, so, that's neat. Anyway. What about security in Mexico City? What were your impressions of the security measures there?
You know, I didn't really even notice them. They took care of the protesters.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, of course, had security. I mean, when we left the venue, you know, it wasn't very far to the bus, so you go and you're out of there.
Mm-hmm.
We had ID tags that we wore. Trying to think if they even had. Yeah, they had our picture on them, and so you know we were identifiable. But you know, thinking back on it, I mean, with what's going on in the world today. Yeah, they could have had a real problem if somebody wanted to do then what they did in Munich.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, they could have walked right in, opened up.
Mm.
Yeah, but, you know, the world wasn't like that then. You know, it took till 72 for the Palestinians to really do so.
Yeah. What about the opening ceremony? What sticks out in your mind, in your memory, from the opening ceremony of the 68 games?
Two things. We spent a lot of time standing up in a group. You know, and when you're dealing with that many people, I mean, I'd been in the Army already, mm-hmm. so I knew about standing and waiting. You know, the Army had a formula on how to move large numbers of people. That's why they designed the marching, you know, and they talk to you about the size or the length of your stride and how many inches that you swung your arms. Not, it wasn't about really how good it looked from some outside perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're marching 200 guys, well, you want the last guy to get there pretty much after the first guy. Otherwise, it becomes like this.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, so when you're dealing with a bunch of athletes who don't understand that, they're all over the place. You know, you have the swimmers who can't spend much time on their feet because of their muscles. And so every time we would get somewhere as a group, all the swimmers sit down just to stay off their feet. And some of the better swimmers elected not to go. So, you know, they had their own thing going, and I don't know what their officials or their heads of delegation thought about it, but I could see their argument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're standing up on your feet for 2 hours and then you got to swim tomorrow, there's a lot at stake there.
Yeah.
So anyway, waiting for our time to march in was a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And being outside the stadium, when things are happening inside and you're missing it, it's just all part of it, because it's a show, not for us really, but for the spectators who come, you know, to watch the march in, which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've seen it on TV and I know the feelings that the athletes have, but I'm sure that many of them thought the same thing that I thought. God, why are we standing out here for this long? And back in 68, the program was as good as they could put together. It wasn't anything like our 84 games, you know, where you had, you know, guys playing George Gershwin on all these grand pianos and stuff like that, or the Chinese opening ceremonies. You just watch it on TV and you're going, oh my God, how did these people do this?
Yeah.
And in watching the Beijing games, I don't think there's another country on the planet that could have done that.
It was pretty remarkable.
You know, yeah. They couldn't have done it. No, they wouldn't have done it. Our people wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And to be so precise with those boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, they did a good games. Uh-huh. You know, their big highlight was to have these big helium-filled Olympic rings, big balloons. And so they let it go up. And so they let it go up from the infield of the track in the stadium. Well, we're still standing out waiting to go in. So we just watched this thing go up, and, you know, that was a big highlight. And so finally when we got to march in and, you know, got the big ovation, everybody kind of broke ranks because they had given us these little cameras. And so they wanted us to, you know, well, okay, what are we going to take a picture of? Well, we're going to go down and take a picture of the Soviet Union because they were, you know, they were our heroes at the time.
Yeah.
So we go down there and take pictures of them, and then we, you know, look for some of the great, great looking women athletes and take pictures of them. And I think I have maybe a half dozen pictures of the lady who brought in the torch. She was the last torch carrier, and she went around the 400 meters, and then they had this kind of extendable ladder thing that went up halfway up the stands. And then it met this other one coming down, so it joined, so she could run up all the way up to the cauldron and light it.
Oh, wow.
Right? It was, you know, for those days, I mean, that was high tech.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was pretty impressive. So I have probably a half a dozen pictures of that girl. But with the camera like this, you know, she looked like about this big. Anyway, but that's kind of what I remember. And the stadium was packed. It's packed. You know, and then you try to take pictures of, you know, our renowned athletes, you know, Toomey and, you know, those guys.
Yeah. Did you get to go to any other events?
I did, yeah. I went to track and field. I went to some swimming. And then a lot of it we just watched on TV back at the Olympic Village. Uh-huh. You know, they had this big hall with easy chairs and TVs and stuff. It was a meeting place. And, you know, the idea was to go and meet athletes from other countries and stuff, which was pretty cool. Uh-huh. The only thing was that they all smoked. Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
The smoke was so thick in there. And it wasn't like our cigarette smoke, which is not good. Mm. It was like, you wondered what was in those cigarettes. Oh, my God. Yeah. And a lot of the foreign athletes smoked.
Hmm.
So I didn't hang out there very much. You know, they had ping pong tables and pool tables and stuff. But just the smoke was horrible. I remember one day I was walking back from the cafeteria to our apartment. And I went by the track on the way back. The walkway was past the track, and there were some athletes on the track working out. And I walked by the high jump area, and there was this one solitary athlete. I don't know where he was from, but he was a black African. And he just had on a pair of shorts, and he was laying on his back, and he was doing these jackknifes like this. You know how he
do
jackknifes?
Yeah.
Well, he'd been doing some, so because he'd already had a little sweat going, but he was as black as that guy's shirt right there through the window.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
I mean, just unbelievable. So I stopped and watched him, and he was just chiseled. I mean, the guy was, and I'm thinking, geez, this guy must be somebody. But I didn't know. And in doing these jackknifes, he was building up so much torque when he would come up, he'd lift his butt this high off the ground.
Oh, wow.
Zoop, like that, and land. Zoop. And I'd never seen him like that before. And I'm thinking, I can't believe that guy could do that, but he's doing it, and I'm seeing it. And then my next thought was, what am I doing here? What, I mean, you have athletes that can do that kind of stuff, and I'm just a volleyball player. Hmm. You know, it kind of makes you think a little bit, you mm-hmm. know. But we were all in the same place, so.
Yeah. Well, 68 was the first summer games where they instituted like an official drug testing program.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that?
Not one thing.
Okay.
I didn't get tested. Uh-huh. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you've talked to other volleyball guys. I don't know if they got tested.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard some stuff, but it was all a part of it. It's like I told you about Lindsey Carter doing the blood testing.
Yeah.
I didn't know if they were trying to bust people or just doing studies, right?
Okay.
So yeah. They had this science thing going on. I don't know. Didn't affect me because I, mm-hmm. you know, I wasn't a druggie, and I didn't get tested, so.
Yeah. What about, like, did your coach or anybody give you a list of substances to make sure you avoided?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Not that I know of. You know, it's funny. I went into volleyball coaching after my playing career, and I was here at San Diego State, as I said, and, you know, we did have that. We had testing. And, you know, I knew a little bit about it, and I spoke to the team about it. But here's what happened. We had a player who was the son of a minister. Great kid. Wasn't a great player. But he left a class. And in order to get to practice on time, he stopped at the bookstore and bought a poppy seed muffin. Ate it on the way to practice. Got called in. Random test. They got him.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. So he had to go. I had to go and testify, you know, what I thought about his character. And, you know, he admitted that he had had this poppy seed muffin. I mean, they sold him in the bookstore, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, they got it. They let him off. But he tested positive.
Wow. That's crazy. It's a really sensitive test, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. So, and you know, and then the more the drug thing came out, the more sophisticated the test became.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guys who were really into that, you know, the long distance guys and all that, some of the strength guys as well, they tried to stay ahead of the test.
Mm.
You know, their doctors would try to stay ahead of the doctors that were administering the test. So it just became a game.
Mm-hmm.
Will I get caught? Will I not get caught? Will this stuff mask it or not?
Yeah.
Seemed like a lot of trouble to me.
Yeah. What about the gender verification tests that were first implemented in 68? Were you aware of that or heard anything about that?
Not at the time.
Uh-huh.
But 72, you know, when they caught the German girls, that became a big thing.
Hmm.
You know. And you know, I'm hearing stuff now about athletes that did test positive and it was covered up later on, 84 even.
Hmm.
You know, 88 they got Ben Johnson. But how many other people tested positive and was covered up by their Olympic committee or whatever?
Hmm.
You know, it's.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I don't know. I guess it's just a sign of the times.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone through the thing with Lance Armstrong and, you know, all the other guys and that are on in the big cycling thing. I mean, they all do it.
Yeah. Well, shifting gears a little bit, you talked about going to some of the other events at the games and track and field. Were you at the track and field event with Tommy Smith and John Carlos?
No, I was not. Okay. I saw it on TV. My plan was to go and watch Beeman, but had I been there, I probably would have left because it was raining, pouring down rain.
Mm,
So, you know, that was too bad. Mm-hmm. That was too bad.
So you were around the village, I assume, for the aftermath of the Smith and Carlos protest. What do you remember about that?
Oh, God, we heard the stories. Oh, they're going to get sent home. They're going to get sanctioned. You know, it's really going to cost them. You know, which was, you know, it was sad. But the funny part about it was, if you think back about the picture, they didn't have a lot of time to plan what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think when Beeman got his medal, he had put on these black socks. You know how blacks, the palm of their hands and the soles of their feet are pink.
Mm-hmm.
And inside their mouth is pink.
Mm-hmm.
So they put on the black socks so that they would be black and not part white.
Okay.
Or appear that way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm thinking, man, that's a stretch. But whatever. And then when the picture came out, they only had one pair of gloves between them.
Uh-huh.
One had this hand up, the other one had this hand up.
Uh-huh.
So how soon before that had they thought of this? I mean, if they'd have thought a day ahead, then they probably could have had two pairs of gloves.
Right.
You know, but and then later on, I remember reading an account by Carlos that he didn't put his hand all the way up. He kind of did like this,
mm-hmm.
because he was afraid he was going to get shot.
Mm.
That's what he said. He was actually afraid at that time.
Oh, wow. I can see that.
So, I don't know.
Turbulent times, and with the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy that same year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scary times. Well, I just have a few more questions to ask. Who was your best friend on the team at the time that you remember being close to at the games?
Well, I had a lot of friends on the team. I hope they would say the same thing about me. But, I got along with everybody. I mean, I had one of my players from San Diego State was on the team. So he played for me and then played with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we played the same position. So we kind of competed against each other as well. And Danny Patterson. And I still see Danny. And it's just something that you accept as part of athletics.
Mm-hmm.
One of my best friends who I coached with for like 40 years, he was also one of my former players. And he'll tell the story. He tells this story about when he was first starting to play and he came down to the beach. And there were only three of us at the beach court.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up. And so he asked me to play. And I really didn't even know him at all. So he came over and asked me to play. And he tells this story about what a jerk I was. He said, we played a whole series of games, and I never spoke one word to him, he tells us. And, you know, we both laugh about it, but we, you know, and I would have to admit, I may not have, because we were in a different place. You know, he was like 5 or 6 years younger.
Oh.
And so I was coaching, but also playing, and he was just learning how to play.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a funny situation, and it might have been true.
Yeah.
But we're so close now. I mean, we're like brothers, and you know, we play golf together. And he's got a couple daughters that are very successful, and you know, I helped raise them and all that. But he remembers that. It's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. So what about the closing ceremony? What do you remember from the closing ceremony?
We got so robbed on the closing ceremonies. The ceremonies were held at a soccer stadium. And soccer stadiums, not in this country, but other countries, they put a big fence around the field to keep spectators from running out. Well, this particular stadium had a moat. A moat and a fence.
Oh, wow.
With spikes on the top. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've heard about the hooliganism that these fans do in other countries.
Yeah.
Well, so they decided I don't know whether it was the Olympic Committee or the U.S. delegation, maybe it was just the U.S. Olympic Committee, decided that they weren't going to allow all the athletes to march because they thought things might get out of hand. So they picked, I don't know if it was individual or maybe teams. Certain teams would be able to march, and then other teams would have to sit in the stands.
Mm.
Well, we were one of the teams that were going to sit in the stands. So we're thinking, why the hell are we even going? You know, the thing is for the athletes to march. I mean, that was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you intermingle with other countries and, you know, do the whole thing, which, you know, is pretty cool. But we weren't going to be able to do that because of this directive. So I remember sitting there watching this, and the athletes were marching in, and they were having a great time, dancing around, holding hands. And so some of our guys decided, hey, this is bullshit. So they ran, jumped into the moat, crossed it, climbed the fence, over the fence, and now they're on the track. And here come the cops, right? And so they're trying to chase our guys down. I mean, it was just so stupid.
Mm.
Just so stupid. So, you know, that was kind of bad.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when the Olympic president came out and awarded the, you know, the thing to Munich, and, you know, the German Olympic guy was there, and I think the German chancellor was even there. And, you know, they passed the flag and all that kind of stuff. That was pretty touching.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good.
So what was your homecoming like, and what kind of reception did you receive when you came back home?
Well, I'll tell you. They flew us into Los Angeles, and it was just a matter of catching a connecting flight to San Diego. Right? So I remember calling my wife and telling her, you know, hey, my plane's coming in at such and such a time. It was going to be in the afternoon. So I land, and there's nobody there. So I'm thinking, what could have happened? You know, so I go to the payphone, and I call the house, and nobody picks up. So I'm thinking, geez, where could they be? Well, maybe they're down at baggage. So I walk down there, and my wife and daughter and son. My son, let's see, this was October. He'd been born in April, end of April. So he was just tiny. So I walk down to baggage, and I'm thinking, God, I can't believe that they're not here. I hope something didn't happen. And so I walk back down to the gate. They're not there. And then I walk back down to baggage. I must have made that walk at least three times. So the fourth time, I'm leaving baggage, and I'm walking up the concourse toward the gate again. And I'm looking, and here's this woman coming with a baby in a stroller and daughter in the hand. And I'm just looking at her and go, what is the deal? She goes, you didn't tell me what airlines. So we've been walking around the airport trying to find each other for, it must have been an hour.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, I could have walked home in that. We lived over here in Point Loma at the time.
Oh.
But that was pretty memorable.
Yeah.
Not for the right reasons, but.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, what did you do after the games as far as your athletic career? Like, just a brief summary. I know you were a coach.
Yeah, I coached at San Diego State, and the Olympics got over in October. Our season didn't start until January. It was a spring sport. So, I was still able to go back and get the team organized in the fall, and we did some training. But we had won in the spring before the Olympics. We had won the collegiate national championship.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good team, although we lost some guys then for the next year. But Yeah, I just kind of went back to work. And I actually had two jobs then, because my job at San Diego State wasn't full time. I worked for the city recreation department.
Oh.
So I had, there's a big gym in Balboa Park, which I was in charge of running. Mm. And during the winter, we ran basketball leagues. I mean, like five nights a week. So that was huge.
Mm-hmm.
God, we had, I think, 180 teams. From all over the county and stuff playing.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so we set up our practice at San Diego State from 11 to 1 in the middle of the day. So it gave me an opportunity then to go home and get something to eat and spend some time before I had to go to the gym,
mm-hmm.
which my hours there were 2:30 to 10:30.
Oh, wow.
So
it's a long day.
Long day.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I've told people before, it wasn't like real work. I mean, it's like going to play for, you know, all that time.
Yeah, that's nice. That is really nice. Well, just a couple more kind of shorter questions maybe. What, for you, was the most meaningful part of being an Olympian?
Well, I think it's now. I think it's later, you know, when you realize that you're part of what those guys, you know, Usain Bolt and those guys you see on TV now, what they're striving to do. We did the same thing. But they've, the Olympic people have done a better job in not allowing the athletes that went before to think of themselves as former Olympians, you know, by keeping them involved in, you know, Olympic Day that's held in June.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go down to the training center here, and you know, they bring kids in from the YMCA or whatever, and you know, I'll talk to them. And I remember one day going down, and they partnered me up with this little boy to do these little games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hadn't planned on doing it. Somebody didn't show up, and they asked me if I would, because I had gone down there to, you know, talk to them. And so I said, sure, absolutely. I wouldn't want the little boy to miss out. So, and we did pretty well in the games. And so it came time where I had to leave. And they hadn't given out the awards yet. And so I went to the person in charge. I says, hey, you know, I got to go now. I hadn't planned on staying as long as I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I filled in for somebody. But I think our team did pretty well. And I don't want to see my partner miss out on any award. So if you go and, you know, add up the scores and let me know, because if he's going to get something, I want to make sure he gets it. I don't want to go off and leave him and then have him forgotten.
Yeah.
And so they said, yeah, you guys did pretty well. You'll either get first, second, or third. I said, okay, well, make sure that Ramon gets his thing, and, you know, because I don't want to, that would be bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they did, and he did get his thing. And so, but they were given these T-shirts. What they call it? They called it the intergenerational games, where a senior was going to do something with the kid.
Aww.
And so they were games that, you know, we could all do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shoot a hockey puck through a thing, or shoot a basketball through a hoop, you know, from like 2 feet away. But they had these shirts on with an Olympic kind of Olympic type logo. I think it was a torch. It wasn't the official Olympic logo, and it had the Olympic colors in it,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I had during my talk, I had one of the kids stand up and display this T-shirt he was wearing, and so I explained the colors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in all the colors of the flags in the world. What does the torch represent? Well, it actually represents two things. It represents the human spirit, and it represents the spirit of competition.
Mm.
That's what it's about. So it's not just about people coming together and competing against one another. That's part of it, but it's about the world and all the different races and religions coming together on this one field to share their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, stuff like that. That's
yeah.
That's what's meaningful now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a lead up to that is having done what we did when we were young.
Yeah, absolutely. So. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I think just treasure the experience. You know, soak it all in. It's just like I just read the book about the dream team, the 92 basketball team. Mm-hmm. And here are these guys that have everything, materially and financially. Why would they want to do this? Mm. But they did. And they had a great experience. And and the things that happened to them during this, they will never forget. I mean, they had, you know, there were some rough times too. There were some political things that came up between them. Isaiah Thomas didn't get selected to the team. He was a great basketball player, but there were some things that other players on the team held against him from the NBA. And two of the really renowned players went to the coach at the time, who was the coach of Isaiah Thomas's NBA team. So you would think that Isaiah would have had it in to make this team. Mm-hmm. And those two players went to Chuck Daly and said, if he's on this team, we won't play. Because of da 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 da.
Wow.
And they were actual things that had happened that they took offense to. And so those were serious things.
Yeah.
And he didn't play. And I'm sure that he regrets it, but I remember a volleyball guy, really a good player, who could have played on our 84 men's volleyball team, who won the gold medal. And this guy, he had an ego, but he was a great player. And so he was training with the national team here in San Diego, and the coach was Doug Beal, and he would decide he wanted to take a couple weeks off, the player, and go to Hawaii with his girlfriend. Mm. So he would just leave. So Beal, you know, would call him in, what's the deal? Why'd you do that? We're going to suspend you for a month. Okay. And so then he would come back, and he would train for a while, and he'd do some other stupid thing like that. So the last thing was that Beal called him in and was going to make him post a $10,000 bond so that if he came back and then did some knucklehead thing, we're going to keep the money.
Oh, wow.
So your choice. You can either join us or tell me right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he elected not to do it.
Huh.
Elected not to do it. So he ended up going to Europe and playing in, you know, Italy or whatever, made some pretty good money, played on the Pro Beach Tour, made pretty good money, but it's not a gold medal.
Yeah.
He's not an Olympian. And so I just thought at the time, when I heard all this, that the Olympics is not for everybody, mm-hmm. but at some point in his life, he will think about that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or tell us about before we wrap up the interview?
No, I think your questions were good, and I gave you as straight as answers as I could.
Yeah,
that's what I do.
So. Yeah, you're a very straight shooter. No, your answers were great. All right, then I'll go ahead and stop the recorder.